Hello?
Hello.
It's good. It's good.
Is that better?
All right, here we are. Tables have turned. We're in the evening. You're in the morning. We don't know how this is going to go. Anyone's game. But we are talking about the anime again.
Again,
Again, because we
but we're
just,
flipping it around.
we're flipping that around. We're flipping everything around. Because now the anime gets to have its response. Decline. Da, da, da. But we should say up front that this will not satisfy the theonomist, right?
Don't know.
We would be naive.
I think they'll be converted from this.
Well, I mean, no. I mean, they will, because we're going to try and be the theonomist for a little bit here, and try and put ourselves in the theonomist's shoes to how would they respond to Klein, and we're going to try our best. But we're not going to try and create a straw man or anything. But we're not going to satisfy. We know. But we're trying to be gracious. This is the thing. Even though you're going to fail, you still try. Hopefully, it's the thought that counts. But I genuinely, in this chapter, by the way, if anyone is wondering what we're doing and where we're coming from, where we're going, we're still doing this thing. We're on Covenant Lord and Cultic Boundary Part 8, the Theonomic Response. This is I think our most consistent series of
We are
all
growing in
time.
character and perseverance.
Yes. Even if we are shrinking our listenership, in doing so, still we will keep pressing on here, and we're looking at the theonomic response again. But I was going to say when I put this chapter together, I was even though I know that how it is. Like if someone writes a chapter about Klein, and was doing this on the other side, it would never satisfy you, and I know that going in. But for what it's worth, for me it was satisfactory because I genuinely felt like I had heard them, and of course there's the challenge of summarizing that into one little bit, which it's very compressed, and there's so much more to say ultimately. But I felt like I would be happy. I was genuinely not trying to present any sort of straw man response from them, and I wanted to look at it. Genuinely, I wanted to see what they would say to Klein and really us, I suppose, in terms of what we hold. And so with that in mind, that's what we want to do. It's kind of
And
an
I think,
interesting way to approach something anyway, even if
yeah, I mean,
it's.
I also think it's very relevant. I mean, we're living in the days of Christian nationalism,
Yes.
the days of theonomy light, the days of Moscow with Doug Wilson.
So
And yeah, so I mean, it's I think a lot of the things that theonomy was saying, I mean, this it's
It's the
right on
backbone.
it's right on the mark.
Yeah, it is. So the more we talk about it now, I mean, the better. And also, we don't often talk about theonomy, actually, even though we say the word a lot. We never really get down to thinking about the nuts and bolts. So this would be good. All right, Andrew, you with us? You're moving around a lot.
I
You're
am.
very distracting.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to make it a little bit brighter somehow. But yeah. I'm with you.
Right.
I'm with you.
Whew,
I'm with
you're a
you. There
mess,
you go.
man. I think I like the nighttime Andrea better. You're a little bit more settled, and
This is very energetic, Andre.
this is very like the coffee has not quite worn
Okay,
off yet.
I'm done. I'm done.
All right.
I'm not moving things around anymore. Okay.
Okay, good. Well, so the question with this sort of thing is like who are you gonna look at primarily in terms of your engagement with Klein? And there are a lot of theonomists, a lot of them really good theologians and good thinkers, and so is it kind of random that we're going to look at Bahnsen and Gentry mostly? No, it's not random because the focus here is Klein and his response, and what Bahnsen did. He was right there in the storm, writing in response to Klein's own critique of theonomy, and then of course you have just that sort of similar culture and history that they shared in many ways. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But also Gentry, I just I think more than anyone else, he sort of made an attempt to take Bahnsen and work with him and be a faithful presentation and expansion of what he was saying. So, in my reading, I mean, I suppose there are more theonomists out there now, but none of them are quite so explicit in engaging with Bahnsen and Klein and the whole debacle back and forward. So, anyways, that's the reason why they become the major interlocutors. And there was a bit of a kerfuffle. Is that a word? Kerfuffle? Kerfuffle?
Yeah, that's a good
Kerfuffle.
word.
I
I like
accept it
it.
as a good word, yeah.
It started out where you know Bahnsen, it was a whole lot of politics going on apparently, in that Bahnsen wrote his big critique on Klein, and or response to Klein, and it didn't get published in the Westminster Theological Journal. It got published in his sort of in-house theonomy journal, and there's all sorts of conspiracy theories as to why that is. But that aside, that's the one we're thinking about, that long response that he wrote, much longer than the one that Klein wrote. And very Bahnsen-esque, you know, it's very clear and well written, and you know, it just covers all the angles. So it's a great source to back and forth with. You got the other guys we should just make mention of, at least, even though we might not say too much about them, and that's Rushdoony and North. Thing is about Rushdoony, well, about North, is he's like just a little bit of a wild card, and everyone sees it that way. You know, he's kind of like just saying extremist things all the time, and you know, probably the least of the
I
balanced
don't know
of the
if
group.
James White sees it that way.
Is that
I
right?
think James White is quite keen on North and Rushdoony.
Well, that makes sense.
So Rushdoony preceded Bahnsen, and wasn't North his son in Bahnsen's son-in-law?
Yeah, they were related. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they worked together in many ways. And, so Rushdoony, I think, was again, I mean, you know, you work through his stuff, and it's powerful. It's good. It's not an easy throwaway. And North is prolific, and you know, he's a good writer, and he's obviously very well educated and very, you know, involved in all these things. But I suppose for me, just he comes across by far as the least balanced of the thing, you know, the least nuanced and the easiest to target. And so I just, you know, I think what a theonomist might be able to say, even if everyone kind of secretly likes him as a theonomist or something, would be that, you know, hey, he was an easy target. You should pick on someone a little bit more, you know, or
Nuanced.
yeah, pick someone that's going to basically
Yeah.
have interacted at that level with Klein. I mean, not, you know, so I don't want to throw North under the bus in that sense, but you know, anyways, that's where the
Where would
cookie
Joe
crumbles.
Boot fit in the kind of spectrum of things?
You know, I haven't read his stuff. I have got his two books on my thing. I mean, we spoke about the one book. I still haven't read it from the last time we spoke about it. And then he's got another one out now, critiquing Two Kingdom Theology. So,
Okay.
what was the first one called again? Mission of the
The mission of God.
Mission of God.
But his thesis is that the Puritans basically taught what he's saying.
Right.
And
And
which I think's that's easy fishing because the Puritans were theocratic,
yeah.
though I don't think theonomic. And my assessment of Boot is that basically he's the political theology without the covenant theology. And
Makes sense.
yeah.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think half of the reason I don't feel too much pressure to go there is because they're all the substantial stuff is going to come from this debate anyway. So if you cover this ground, you're basically, I mean, no one's brought too much extra to the table afterwards, I don't think. Well, you know, again, I might be able to stand corrected. I definitely plan on reading his book, but you know, at the moment, let's work with what we got here. And let, you know, again, we're just kind of working with the chapter, helping people to see. His book came out just after this was published. So it was just
Okay.
I think it was literally on the same month or something that I remember getting that and saying, oh man, that's cool. I want to read it. But
And that's exactly what you want to read after your you've just
yeah.
finished your
No, yeah.
PhD.
There is no way I was gonna be able to handle that. But anyway, so for any readers that are interested in seeing how that follows, I think from all the feedback I've heard, much of what is covered here basically, you know, is relevant as you go through and look at the rest of that book. Look at the recent literature that's come out since then. Feels weird to say since then, but yeah, it has been a few years. And again, our task now is just to kind of help readers just work through the actual content of this book. So with that in mind, thinking about this whole, they make a few points, right? So let's just cover them sort of broadly speaking. One of the first ones that both Barnes and Gentry sort of take up is this matter of the Westminster Confession, and to what degree is its character theonomic? They both immediately sort of focus in on the fact that Klein seemed to give some ground on this point, that he acknowledged there was some sort of tension or tendency in the Westminster to move in a theonomic direction. Anyways, obviously Klein was saying that in a way that wasn't good, but they're like, okay, great, yes, at least, well, that's one for Klein. At least he's honest about that, and we agree, and that's why we should be theonomists. And so, it is what it is. I suppose why it matters is because if that's true, theonomy immediately has a more respectable grounding. It comes out, it has a real precedent in the Westminster, and that means everyone who cares about Westminster needs to have a closer look at that issue. So that's one. We can come back to this in a second. But then the other is the big line of argument would be Klein's kind of overworking of ancient Near Eastern documents to come up with hypothesis suggestive ideas. So in other words, ideas that actually frame his view of what's going on. So basically allowing the external literature to interpret the Bible rather than the Bible interpreting itself. So that's one of the big,
Which is a
and it,
critique that Klein gets, not
yeah,
just from the theonomy camp, like it's
that's
a
true.
general critique.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why I think it does need to be taken seriously. I mean, it is like worth pointing out that a lot of the theonomists themselves don't have that kind of problem with Klein at all, and that they really do embrace a lot of his insights. I always think, Frame's not exactly in this camp, but I think of Frame, for example, who says that's the one good thing about, Klein, and then he builds his whole system on it, or some of the other guys in the theonomy camp as well. But anyways, leaving them aside right now, that I think just because other people have critiqued Klein on that point is worth looking at, especially if it's going to make the difference, as Klein argues, for seeing things in terms of a certain covenantal structure in the Mosaic Covenant. If that's as important as he says, then that's going to be quite a make or break issue. So it makes sense that Bonson went for that anyway. Thirdly, there's this matter of reformed hermeneutic, shall we say. So that in the basic sort of sweep of reformed theology, you have this drift towards continuity. Yeah, everyone would acknowledge some discontinuity, but the strong precedent is for continuity. So it's like one. Yeah, we're not talking monocovenantalism, so as much as we're just talking about, this within the covenant of grace, there's not like an old and new covenant. There is just the covenant of grace. There's the old and the
Older and
newer.
newer covenants.
Exactly. So all to really bring to the fore what everyone appreciates to some degree, this hermeneutic of continuity in Reformed theology. And so he doesn't like what Klein's done there with the Mosaic Covenant and putting it in antithesis to the new, and so forth. And then just one or two more here before we start chatting this through. There's his view of the kingdom, right? So he's going, there's no need for this two kingdom stuff because you can just think about this in terms of its objective reality and it's becoming a reality. There's what he calls the de jure reign of Christ and the de facto reign of Christ. So it's one kingdom, but there's two senses in which he reigns. The one is a legal objective de jure reign. The other one is kind of what we can sense and see right now, which again is not overly problematic as you think about it right there, but it's just that it could be saying something that's in line with the rest. If you bring in the rest of what he's saying there with the Mosaic Covenant, that's when it becomes a problem. He also wants to just emphasize the typology aspect is it's not either or for theonomists. So a theonomist wants to, he doesn't want to say, hey, Klein is wrong in that there's no typology in the Old Testament. It's only normative. They're just saying, why do we have to choose? You know, let's have typology, sure, but let's just understand it as normative as well in most ways. So there's a lot to talk about there. You know, so he, for example, says the big famous one is that you've got too much detail in the Mosaic Covenant to throw it all in the typology bucket. What about these specific laws against criminals and this and that? How does that serve the broader typological purpose? That's where I think he actually misses it quite big time. We'll come back to that in a second. Of course, the main one is that if everyone's not under the law of Israel, then there's a double standard in God. You know, so there's only one law, one morality in God. So how can you talk about one sort of law for the nations, another one for Israel? That's compromising on the doctrine of simplicity. Off it goes, right? And what else? Anything
That'll
else?
resonate with people today, the doctrine of
I
simplicity
think
that's been revived.
totally. And then I think the other one is just the nuts and bolts, you know. So often they get flack for saying, hey, you know, we're going to kill the mission field and so forth. But they're saying, no, we want to. And I think we've made this point sufficiently in the past. But you know, they're saying we just want to institute a polity that when it becomes, you know, a democratic decision, that's when, you know, there will be this imposition of the Mosaic law. We're not going to go in and just start wiping people out. And you know, Joshua of conquest of Joshua style, but at the same time, once that is in play, there is a real implication for treason. But they want to say it's like a public display. It's not like every sin of the heart gets, you know, met with this penalty of the law. So there is a reasonableness there, in that you can almost imagine that should there be a majority Christian society, and they're thinking, how do we institute Christian government? Well, they're going to go, where else are you going to look? You know, we've got this manual for statecraft at some level or another in our Bibles. Obviously, we need to go there. And yes, it does have these, you know, severe implications for treason and subversion of you know, what the government would be upholding at that point. But you know, it's too simplistic just to say we're going to walk in, you know, and try and overtake and just, you know, get rid of anyone who doesn't agree. And so I think that's enough. There are a few other bits and bobs there, but you know, that'll keep us busy for this
Well,
time.
maybe one other, maybe we could elaborate on this just moving forward, is Bahnsen critiqued Klein's two canons.
Oh, true, sure. Yeah.
Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I suppose I had that in mind with the continuity piece.
Okay.
So yeah,
De
he has,
degrees. Yeah.
right. So Klein comes along and he goes, wait a minute, you've got these two canons, old and new covenant. And I don't think Bahnsen misunderstood what he was saying. I think he did get that all Klein was saying, really, even though, you know, admittedly in the most unhelpful way possible, you know, he was saying that you have these two constituting documents for Old and New Covenant, respectively. But even getting that, I think Bahnsen didn't want that. He was like, no, we don't have two constituting documents. We have one overarching covenant of grace. So we read the new in light of the old that's been set up. And so you don't go ahead and just say, hey, listen, we've got this whole new thing going on with the new covenant. And really, this is much of what we know already by, you know, Paedobaptist argumentation and so forth. You know, if it's no, we don't want to make no, if it's not saying anything to explicitly stop the practice, then you know, we just go ahead with it, assuming this continuity. And interestingly, I do mention somewhere in the chapter that, you know, it is, you know, Waldron, good old Sam Waldron in the Reformed Baptist camp, you know, he did make the comment, and I think this is something that one way or another needs to be considered, that very hermeneutic of paedobaptism is ultimately, you know, I mean, it's like, to be fair to Bahnsen, he's just working with that. He's just doing that at a consistent level. And every Baptist can resonate with that at some level, even though I know not all Presbyterians will appreciate that point equally. But the
Can't
other
think why.
But other than that, I mean, you know, it is true. You read some of this stuff and you see the Baptists and the Kleinians lumped together by the Theonomists. You know, they're just thinking almost, if you're going to bring in some level of discontinuity or Klein's two canon idea, interestingly enough, you do find it in Baptist literature all the time. No reference to ancient Near Eastern stuff. But like Fred Malone, for example, you know, argues almost verbatim the same thing. but you know, with that, with just basically hermeneutics, getting him there. So anyways, we could talk more about that as we go. All right, what do you want to talk about of all that stuff? It's like a salad buffet.
Well, maybe
So much
just
stuff.
could we just start and just touch on the whole Westminster tension thing. So is there something, I
Yes.
mean, I know this is not like there's a bit of an in-house question for Presbyterians
Yeah.
at some level, but because the Westminster is so significant in post-Reformation theology, and also like the 1689 is basically the Westminster in lots of ways, but probably in these moments substantially different. So I don't know, maybe just point, is there a tension between the original from your book? I picked up there was a kind of tension between the original Westminster and then a later American
Yeah,
revision.
they made the revision, and they took all the Erasmian bits out,
So
oh no,
the
Erasmian,
old
Erastian.
Erasmian view is
Is it
established
Erastian?
Erastian view, sorry.
Yeah,
That's
Erasmian is the dodgy Greek guy, the dodgy Greek pronunciation.
So Erastianism is basically a carryover from the Roman Empire as it influenced the Constantinian Christendom, and sort of a carry on from that rubric. But establishmentarianism. So if you go back and you read the Puritans, you'll come across establishmentarianism, and that's the view that is summed up in the older unrevised Westminster Confession of Faith, that the king has a part to play. That politics has a part to play in the establishing of the church nationally. So Christian nationalism loves establishmentarianism. And I was actually asking a Presbyterian brother the other day, do you subscribe to the Scottish mindset that's enshrined in the old Westminster before the Americans changed it? I said, are you an establishmentarian? He says, yes.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
No. So that whole thing of national covenants that
Yes,
the Scottish
yes,
covenant
yes.
has made, where the nation is seen as under God, and so as a nation you're making a covenant before God, and
Yes.
you're a corporate body, which is a Christian body as a nation before God, and God is dealing with you as a nation as he would have dealt with Israel according to the laws. And so that all goes under establishmentarianism.
Yeah, exactly. And it so it plucks on a deep heartstring there. With as you're saying, with many Presbyterians will have that. I'll never forget. I had a similar conversation where I was, giving this lecture in a situation where, I was just saying, I wasn't even coming close to anything too kingdom, but I was just saying, so, this is why we don't need to go and, kill, and get rid of, and I was just overstating this whole idea of any cults, we have to tolerate cults. We can't just like get rid of them, and I was met with such, vitriol in that. Well, that, yes, we have to get rid of them, and this is why we need to get into politics. And it wasn't really the frightening thing about the discussion was that it wasn't really coming at it from any particular sort of Christian nationalism or theonomy. It was just, oh yeah, that's what all Reformed Christians believe based on the confession, and so it had this latent kind of thing. So I did think about this because you have, everyone feels that at some level there is this. Even the, you take the Erastian bits out, but you've got this thing there, this ghost that's still in play, even if in the history, let alone the actual confession itself, that just needs to be dealt with. And I think that's all Klein was really acknowledging. But as Lee Ines points out, it might be that in the revision, Klein wasn't really going there. He was just kind of going, well, I'm leaving the question open, just. Potentially, there's some inconsistency at a historical level, but as Ayn said, it might be that by their taking that out, even though there was inner consistency left, inner inconsistency, should I say, left, or tension left in the Westminster, there was still that action was enough to say, hey, we think theonomy's wrong. So even if there is that there. We don't want it, So yeah, we're dealing with this whatever remains there are in this confession, but we don't want it. So there's also that potential historically. So I don't know. I haven't looked at that at all,
I
but
mean, I think just looking at the nomology of the standards, Westminster especially, is I think that, as we talk about the first, second, and third use of the law, I think that it does play into the theonomist's hands. So the third use of the law, you know,
the
Holy Spirit uses it in terms of sanctification. I think we would all agree that the law is still beneficial for study, still reveals the will of God. It still has positive things to say about marriage and parenthood and a whole bunch of other stuff that are really helpful. You can go through all 10 of the commandments, and you will, if you meditate on them as a Christian and not for salvation, you know, there is tremendous benefit to be had there. Second use of the law, Luther's use of the law is a mirror, you know, increases the knowledge of sin. We're all agreed. But it's that first use of the law, you know, that it's the governmental use of the law, that the law is useful to establish proper principles of jurisprudence so that all the countries of the world can benefit from God's law and set up good governments, which will be beneficial to all the people of the land.
Right.
And, you know, as if you've got no nuance on the first use of the law, you know, basically you're playing into the whole theonomy project.
Right.
And I think that was the baseline of the nomology of the Westminster Confession. I think you quoted T. David Gordon. You know, there's no covenantless communication of the law or whatever the phrase.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. and he was saying that what the confession does is sort of promotes or inclines itself towards a covenantless view of the Mosaic law. And as soon as you rip it apart and start turning it into abstract, timeless principles, you're back to that thing that we've been talking about over the past few sessions, where you know, you're not dealing with it as a covenant, you're not dealing with it as in terms of its unique situation and all that means at typological level. So yeah, I mean, I think that it's a real point, and you know, so one way or another they got to deal with that, but For Baptists, it is like, this is the thing. I mean, whatever latent kind of move was there in saying, hey, you know, we're not, if they were saying, hey, we're not into anything theonomic by this revision, well, Baptists said it all the more. And that's just, no one can really deny that. And that we literally stripped everything out. But you might even say that for the same reason, there is still some stuff in the Baptist confession, you know, covenantless upholding of the Mosaic law. That you know, could give some precedent for some, you know, Baptists to think in the same direction. So it'll be more.
Well, I mean, lots of Baptists hold to the three uses of the law in the same way that Nick was talking about. So just at that level, it's
just
gonna...
at that level. Now we'd have stripped out the hermeneutic to get there.
Yeah,
you know, while holding that, so it makes it a lot less dangerous. But at the same time, you know, we're seeing it, aren't we? We're seeing a few things go in that direction now. So,
but the other thing that brings right to the fore, sorry, Nick, the thing that brings right to the fore, and this might be skipping ahead a little bit, but it just seems like a point worth making is that highlights the whole common grace thing. So if you're not going to have the first use of the law as a way to, for the nations to govern themselves, you know, what then fills that space?
Yes, exactly.
So you have to then have something of kind of natural law. You have to have something of common grace sphere, you know, some other way to account for how the nations are going to rule themselves and how God is going to rule over the nations, you know, apart from this covenantal administering of the, you know, of the first use of the law.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me use the fourth commandment as an example, because you know, we recognize that the Sabbath day was given as a sign of the covenant, of the Mosaic covenant, which was a typological republication of the covenant of works. And so if you're going to say that the fourth commandment is not only a civil ceremonial typological law, but it also has a moral law basis, because it's also a creation norm, you know, basically, let's say we agree that the fourth commandment applies, it is part of God's moral law. It's for all times and all places. And so how would we see it applied in the Noahic covenant, even though it's not specifically enshrined? So we would recognize that even if there was a pattern of work and worship that should have regulated man's life, it wasn't given for the purpose of regulating it at the level of government, but only at the level of the individual. So, you know, you can still hold a nuanced position. So you're basically saying, like, oh, sure, you know, the Lord always wants everyone to regulate their lives around regularly gathering with the Lord's people, and you know, putting yourself to regular work the rest of the time. And but don't make the government the one that enforces it.
Yeah, even more generally than that, like it's good for creatures to worship God, you know.
Yes.
So there's that like that moral sort of like on the heart thing.
Yeah, I'd leave that to the first commandment, but yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, what I mean is at a certain time in the week in a certain way, like
Right.
according to the way
A
God
pattern
himself,
of life
the way
that
that God
regulates you as
himself
worshippers. Yeah.
dictates. So God should choose how you do that, basically, is what I'm saying. And you know, that I think is fair enough. You know, but again, it kind of gets into a slightly different topic. But at the same time,
Well,
yeah.
sorry, can
Perfect.
I just make a quick point?
Yeah,
So
yeah.
I know that we don't agree on the Sabbath, but you, from my perspective, I'm seeing that, listen, the only time the Sabbath is ever given as a law is within that covenant administration made with Israel through
And Eden.
Moses. No, not in Eden. I don't see that in Eden at all. I'm not trying to bring us back to that discussion, but I'm just saying that where it appears as a commandment, ever for human beings, I think in Eden it appears as something entirely different. That's all. But anyway, I'll just to say that therefore, you only see it.
You're
What does
baiting me.
it?
You're baiting me.
What does
Is
it appear in Eden as? Well,
it's
it
the
a sign of the
consummation.
covenant?
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's the hope. It's the offer of reward. It's not something that Adam, it was what Adam was trying to get to. It wasn't what Adam had to do.
Okay. That's
We won't
no, no,
reopen
yes,
that
no, no.
conversation.
No, anyway, okay, this is a red herring. Never mind. I was just going to say, look, it only appears in Moses anyway. So if you're going to take that and apply it in any way, shape, or form, you're trying to do that thing. You're trying to take a covenantal administration and apply it non-covenantally to the rest of the world. It just
So
doesn't work.
I guess what I was trying to say is the view that I was proposing does allow for some continuity without all of the continuity that the Westminster Confession is pushing. Whereas I think
Sure.
your position would probably strike towards more discontinuity.
Yeah.
But that aside,
Okay.
yeah.
So I think probably one of the bigger things here is that, so on the one hand, there's the issue of continuity. To what degree should the mosaic be viewed in continuity with the new, which is a big subject, obviously. But then on the other side is this kind of logical process that, you know, it not only does it carry through from old to new covenant, and you know, they would try and show you that via their covenant theology, but it needs to, because you know, because the law is synonymous with the Mosaic law is synonymous with the moral law in that sense. There is a kind of there's no, you know, they're doing the opposite form of what we're trying to do. We're trying to say, yes, you got to view the Mosaic covenant as a kind of piece, so don't go and apply little bits and bobs of it. And they're going, well, yes, in the sense that you got to view it as a piece, but the whole piece gets reapplied. You know, and so they agree that it's a piece, but it's like the whole thing applies to everyone, where we're saying, no, that's kind of not the point. And they're logic goes like this. You know, we see the prophets applying the law, the moral law, to the Gentiles. Well, that shows that God hasn't got two standards but one. And so I think our big response to this is that would be very convincing if it was the only place in which you could find the moral law. So if there was no moral law except that which was given to Israel, and that's the end of it, then sure, if that moral law is being applied elsewhere, then you know, Bob's your uncle, you're done. But at the same time, if that moral law is already written on their hearts and there's the correspondence there, then obviously, you know, that moral law is going to be applied, because that's the whole point. And we would see this as being quite a big point as it relates to things like the covenant of works and Sabbath and so forth. And the whole biblical story really ties in around this idea that you have what is given to Israel is now making explicit at a level what is already written on, you know, all in Adam's heart that have fallen, and now reinforces the point of their fallenness, so that We, along with Israel, need grace. So that, so that doesn't make the point that they wanted to make. That, if anything, makes the counterpoint, I think. So there's that. And then, of course, there's the reality that they claim that if that is the case, if you're saying that there is no way to go, but you're sort of taking all the information away from us, and you're locking it, you're limiting the application of scripture. It's only for Israel, and you can't use this anywhere else. And we're saying, well, this is again kind of like there's a don't forget, there's a moral law, and there's natural law, and all this stuff is there. It's not the Mosaic law does correspond to it, but like you don't need a Mosaic law to learn how to do math. You don't need a Mosaic law to learn how to do engineering, and that's okay to say, and there is a natural law and a way to do things.
I think that Bahnsen being a Vantillian, it definitely impacted on his version of theonomy.
Yes.
So I was having a conversation with a beloved theonomist Presbyterian brother, the same one that's an establishmentarian. And we were talking about, and I was saying, look, you don't, or because basically, I think the underlying assumption is that all the Mosaic law is based on the moral law. But what we're saying is, we're saying yes, there is moral law in the Mosaic law, but there's a whole bunch of eschatological and typological stuff as well.
Yeah, there's a unit. Yeah.
Because if every Mosaic law is based on moral law, then all Mosaic law must apply universally into everybody else,
Yes.
and that's the problem that they're making.
Yeah.
And so I was saying, no, there is such a thing as natural law. We see it in the Noahic covenant. And then his pushback was this. He says, I do not see anywhere in history a type of Wakanda, a place where, natural law has given any particular government of the world all of the capital, the intellectual capital, the moral capital that we see in the Mosaic law. I don't see any other, Israel stood out as a light amongst the nations. Therefore, we need the Mosaic law and not natural law to get us to where we need to go. And I said, well, look, I think you're begging the question by saying it needs to look like Wakanda. What about Roman Dutch law? Let's emphasize the word Roman. where we see Rome drawing on all the Greek
Yeah.
culture that it
Yeah.
adopted and put into its incredible gifted administrativeness there, and the laws that it brought into being, which did inform and help Constantine as he built Christendom,
Yeah.
for better or for worse.
And also going back to like Klein's work to show that actually there was a hang of a lot of crossover between ancient Near Eastern morals and the Ten Commandments. Like the covenant requirements and that were well, they were different. There were differences, but there was a lot of crossover. Or Proverbs, there's a lot of crossover. So I think that maybe we can overstate those differences. Israel were meant to be the law was given to Israel to be distinct in particular ways. So we sometimes, and this is where why Christians get caught up on this, because they expect the Mosaic covenant to be describing a kind of utopia. And so they're surprised when they read certain laws that don't sound very utopian at all. In fact, they sound substandard to our Judeo-Christian laws. That's because it's a misunderstanding. I don't think the Mosaic covenant was meant to make them stand out as this kind of utopian or Wakandan society. It was meant to make them stand out in particular ways,
Well, and
Right?
also, absolutely. But there's also this thing that, okay, just think about the history of Israel. Sure, they for a moment were glimmering and shining there with David and Solomon, right? And that for very typological reasons, I might add, as they were enabled to obey, and along with the theocratic king, key point, along with the theocratic king, the messianic anointed king, the son of David, as they were able to flourish to the point that they were a light to the nations. When else were they a light to the nations exactly? I mean, were they a light? Was it I don't know.
I think it was during the reign of kings.
I mean, Judges was pretty awesome. Yeah, I mean, like, not, Judges was great. You know,
and then
wasn't the exile?
I mean, okay, so we got not that.
Wasn't the intertestamental period?
No. So we're running out of time. And you know, this is the problem. Like, I think that this is to make this mistake kind of enters into the realm of the Pharisaic era, you know, or the mistake that they were making, because and it, you know, we should be careful of this, because this is what Jesus got cross with. You know, he was angry with this thing, in that the whole thing was given to show them that, okay, fine, when the reigning messianic king, the anointed one, comes and rules over you, and you know, then fine, we're into this typological reality. But at every other point, from the moment you got the law at Sinai all the way through to the end, it crushed you, in the sense that you have nothing. By the time of the exile, the point there the prophets were making were, you have absolutely, it's decreated, you're absolved back into Babylon, you got nothing. This remnant coming forth is going to be like a new creation, and you know, the big point that they make again and again is, you have nothing with which to lay hold of any sort of claim to God and say, you know, this is what we've done, therefore we deserve it. As Adam has broken the covenant, so you have broken the covenant. As Adam needed grace, so you needed grace. Behold, the new covenant is coming. And then Jesus comes along and they go, oh, no, actually, we're doing great. You know, we just need someone to kind of, you know, look at our history. It's proof that we are nailing this thing. And for whatever we are lacking, well, that's what we're here for as the Pharisees. All we really need, you know, we've got the law thing sorted now. All we really need is a political deliverer. So if you're not wanting to do that, then so, whoa, you know,
yeah, a figurehead, like really.
A figurehead. Yeah. And you know, just even talking like that sounds theonomic. You know, it's based on the wrong understanding. But we're the light to the nations. But what, are we going to let the Gentiles rule? What are, you know, how dare we even insinuate that there could be another thing going on? This is not good. This is exactly what, you know, this is the problem, big time, in the Gospels.
And you can take it forward. You can take it into church history.
Right.
And say, when, you know, name me the period where this went well in church history, you know, where we had this kind of haven. Now, there were some benefits, obviously. You know, there were certain things that shone forth in Christendom. You
like know, the way that ministers get holidays and stuff like that.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, like people respected pastors in Christendom.
those benefits. We got tax rebates. What's
interesting is I actually heard someone say the other, I was watching a debate on Reform Forum, and the establishmentarian representative basically said, well, I think the establishment did okay. You know, everywhere the establishment happened, things got better. And so they would look at history and say, you know, it does make our case for us. Everywhere that Christian kings and queens were put in place and did protect the church, you know, rape was down, murder was down. But again, I think it's a very shallow appeal to history. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Cause no one would deny that there weren't some benefits. So like obviously some good things came out of it, you know,
it worked but, well as a restraining grace.
Well, and also you see, this is
didn't hold the kingdom,
because no one's against a government being Christian and doing things that are good. You know, then that's where the tricky bit comes in here. You know, like, let's say for example, like who among the most staunch, I don't know, like dualists, two kingdom Lutherans, you know, I don't know, he's using theonomous swear words here. Who amongst the most extreme of those would feel in any way, let's make him Lutheran Baptist, let's really say Lutheran
libertarians.
Libertarians. Let's say now all of a sudden in New Zealand, you had this like something happened and all the whole national party, you know, all confess Christ and yet just carry on as the national party, right? I mean, they would do good things. There's no doubt about it. And there would be a good sort of, you know, realistic engagement with society at the same time. And a lot of what those good parts of that previous system can boil down to, I think, are just, is just that was right. Good. And no one's got a problem with that. And in the same breath, where it went beyond that is where the bad parts come in.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So And then, maybe, I don't know, I don't want to get too far down this track, but there was that little renaissance in the Muslim world as well. When was that again? When everyone was just like, all the languages come from there and everything's just,
It's just before
Aristotle.
Aquinas. Yeah.
Right. And
Yes.
so, let's not forget that sort of stuff as well, where you have this kind of different, although there is at least a biblical sort of grounding in what they were
And
doing.
so you had the Muslim Renaissance, and then you had the European Renaissance, which preceded the Reformation. These were things that God was doing in culture.
And whenever I give myself, let's say I allow myself a thought experiment of, okay, well, let's go, theonomy, we're all in, I immediately come across that problem in some way, shape, or whether it be the ancient Greeks, or whether it be Chinese civilization and Confucius, or whether it be, I mean, we're not saying that those were in any way, but there is common grace there. It's impossible for me to deny that it wasn't a lawless society. Let's put it that way. I mean, there was some stuff going on there that who else are you going to give credit for that? It's God, and there is a moral law that came through that again corresponds to what we were saying earlier with ancient Near Eastern stuff and the various moralities and wisdom, forms of literature that were upheld at that point. So yeah, anyways, you got to have a space for common grace. That's the other side of this.
Just maybe staying on track, I like you bring up Mu in his critique of theonomy, sort of isolates their idea into a syllogism,
Yes.
and I love the syllogism. So it's just picking up with what we've been saying.
Yeah.
He says the theonomous logic may be syllogized as follows. The first premise is that the Sinai covenant contains the moral law. So that's do we make every single law of Moses based on the moral law, yes or no? So as far as the Ten Commandments is concerned, mostly for the most part, we probably all agree, but it's all the other laws that theonomy wants to bring in with it. So that's the first premise. The Sinai covenant contains the moral law. Their second premise is that the moral law is applied universally. So moral law by definition is for everyone everywhere. And so the conclusion is drawn from these two premises that the Sinaitic law is therefore to be universally applied. And he says, while the premises are agreeable to all, it is the conclusion that is problematic. This is due to its leap in the argument. As Mu says, if the logic would stand and only would need to be included as part of the first premise. In other words, it would need to be premised that God's moral law can only be found in the Sinai covenant, which is denies natural law. And
Right. Yeah. What we were saying earlier. Yeah. Good. Yeah. No. Really well written. Are we talking about Mu or me?
Someone
I
did a
don't
really good job of writing
know. No, that was all Mu. But
that.
we.
Was all Mu, or this, or Mu, or
Me.
me, or
Like Mu in the Greek sense, Mu.
Mu.
Genitive of me.
So that's that, right? Now, the other things, just quickly, because we're kind of running out of time, as to be expected. The thing we need to just quickly talk about is the hypothesis suggestive stuff in Klein. That's the one it's okay to leave out now because we come back to it later. In that there is a lot to talk about with Klein in that, but I think the big point I would want to make now is, and this is a, for anyone that cares about this, they should take it seriously. We agree with Bahnsen. I agree with Bahnsen. You shouldn't allow ancient Near Eastern anything to determine your doctrine. Like you shouldn't allow any historical context to be the determiner of doctrinal truth. I mean, the norming norm, right? The word is the ultimate authority. So yeah, these things help us and they come along and they give us insight, but it is the word. So I agree with Bahnsen there. I just don't think it's true that Klein did that. And the way I can prove it is you just read through his literature. I have not been able to find a single instance of him doing that. I can't even come close to doing that. What he does is what you see a lot of in Klein is making a thorough, like ridiculously thorough exegetical case, convincing exegetical biblical theological case, and then going, look, there is total harmony here with what I also know to be true here. I mean, you see that everywhere in Klein, and maybe it's just the fact that he's always saying that it gives people in the impression that he's allowing that to dominate. But he's an ancient Near Eastern scholar. I mean, that's what he's going to do. But then you don't want to confuse that with whether he's actually sort of bringing his doctrine from historical context rather than scripture. So, this is something that I've faced quite a lot as soon as I want to kind of bring this in. And, Bible believers don't like to talk about it sometimes, and they're like, we just want to believe that, God invented everything. And, they don't even like the fact that like circumcision was around, and and yet all of these things were there and important. And, we are, you have to know about them to help you understand, how they would have understood these words and Pentateuch and so forth. And so, if anything, we're not taking the Bible seriously when we don't do that. I think that we're just making up our own context and going, well, look, Moses, leapfrogged into a post-Enlightenment scientific sort of world and gave us a nice account of the creation, and to be our science textbook today, and to be homeschooled in schools everywhere and so forth. I think this becomes a less faithful way of dealing with it. So I don't think that stands ultimately. The two covenant canons we've spoken about, all he meant there was two constituting documents. So as Baptists, we believe that anyway, whether you agree with Klein or not.
Two standards.
What's that?
Two standards of
Two
law.
standards we've just covered. Yeah, good. So, and then the one thing to talk about there would just be the issue of, well, I suppose we mentioned this as well, but the issue of typology, in that they want to allow for typology, but not Klein's total system. Now, I mentioned earlier that, they would say, well, what about, the execution of a rapist, for example, under Mosaic law? How on earth does that point to what Klein's saying the law points to? Surely there's some extra bits, concerning legal ramifications and so forth, and just good governance of society. But what we're saying, what I'm saying, and what I think Klein's saying is like, no, that's the point. That's the whole thing right there. That ruthless no toleration, no deviation from the kingdom ethic, no allowance, this pure, holy entirety is the whole point, that there will come a time when the true theocratic king institutes a reign like this, and there will be no divergence from Yahweh's ethic, and there will be hell, and there will be heaven, and there will be, those who have sin entirely removed, and there will be those who are in sin for all eternity. And this is exactly what the law is communicating in all its parts. But of course, as Klein says, the point we made a while ago, and the point that I haven't seen Theonomists come back on adequately, is what about the Messianic King? This is like the all-important point. The whole thing was set up to appreciate what was happening with David and Solomon, the anointed Messianic King. Well, you can't, I mean, surely. You can't have a system like this in play today without that Messianic king. So it's not a matter of going, we want to keep some typology. The whole point is like the whole thing is built to uphold that typology. How could you want to take the main one away? It's not that you just want to hold some, you want to take the heartbeat away from this thing. And that seems ridiculous. So I think Klein's point stands, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely.
Which isn't.
And sorry, Andre, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, in some ways, it sums up, I think, the big problem with theonomy is it's wanting right things, but wanting them at the wrong time, and therefore it's not able to, even though it's not able to get what it wants, because it has to do exactly what you said. It has to actually leave out the most important parts
It has to change the
of the
law.
whole vision.
It has to. It doesn't accept the law as it is. The law was given, and all of a sudden now they're the ones not taking seriously every stipulation in the law, which is this, a very clear thing. You can't just amend it, and that's what the Pharisees were doing again. This is the thing that they got into trouble for, just changing and tweaking, and you got to keep it as is, which is like the whole thing. How can we uphold the law as it was revealed? Well, it's not via theonomy, it's via understanding it. Being fulfilled in Christ. You uphold Christ as the fulfiller of those things, and the whole package deal now, having been fulfilled in him, and the consummation and the end and so forth, that's how you uphold every jot and tittle. It's kind of like, it reminds me of the imprecatory Psalms, in there you got two options there. you could say, oh, well, let's just, when he meant like smash the baby against the rock, he didn't mean like baby, baby. And he didn't mean like rock, rock. I mean, he was obviously talking about a soft rock.
He didn't mean
rock.
Smash, smash.
He didn't mean smash, smash. He just meant like, you know, or you could go, again, that's what he meant. And that's what theocratic kings do. And that's the whole thing that Jesus is going to do at the end. You know what I mean? So the one keeps the psalm intact without compromising the fact that, you know, now in common grace, we are to turn the other cheek. And yet we hope for that theocratic end. Yeah. But the other plays around with the word, changes the word, tries to soften its blow, as it were. And that's the real problem. Yeah.
So coming to capital punishment, I sort of divide it up into three types of capital punishment. So you have in the Noahic covenant, you have some capital punishment in accordance with the second table of the law. As a restraining grace in keeping with God governing over believers and unbelievers alike without pouring out his judgment day verdicts through those laws.
Mm.
Then you move into the Mosaic covenant, and there you have a typological eschatological intrusion where the future kingdom of God is being put on display. And so you're seeing a more intensive application. So here some sins are crimes. Here much more sins are crimes as God is putting his eschatological judgment on display. In the new creation, you know, well, all sin is crime and all sin will be eradicated. And so that's the perfect ultimate consummated sort of...
Yeah.
It takes the Mosaic paradigm to its logical conclusion.
Perfect, perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. And again, that's where the execution of a rapist fits in, you know, in this. Good. Well, okay, we've got to draw it to a close, but maybe just as a sort of closing thought here, if we did say, you know, the rhetoric is harsh back and forward, and so often the Ottomans will point out, Klein's all screaming at everyone and Bonson's cool as a cucumber as he responds. And, you know, the problem with the way he responds is not only that, you know, the argument I don't think stands ultimately, but that he presents this long, cool response as if it's kind of this, most of the space of the argument is taken up on what Reformed Christians already agree on anyway. And then he gives you the impression at the end. And so it's in danger of ingenuity.
Disingenuous.
Yeah, disingenuous. In that it gives you the impression that you know, all we're asking for here as theonomists is just to take the law seriously. Can we just take the Bible seriously? Can we just do that? And I think, and that was a clever play. And obviously he's just doing his thing and trying not to, you know, file the harsh bits down and make his entry into the argument. But I think that, you know, anyone that reads this has to be careful with that because, you know, that's not what's going on. I mean, that's Calvin, you know, even in the days of Christendom, didn't approve of that kind of reasoning and, you know, explicitly so. How much more controversial is it to do what Bunsen was arguing for in his time? And same with us. How much more? It's a controversial proposal. And it's not just taking the Bible seriously. If anything, as we've said, you know, it is in danger of doing the opposite. It's in danger of filing the corners down. But also, it's more than just serious or not serious. It's you know, it's a theology in view. There's a backbone to this thing. And that backbone depends on whether one will ultimately embrace their covenant theology. All comes down to covenant theology. All comes to the covenant at the end of the day. Everything comes to the covenant. But you know, this is again what people have to consider as they work through it. It's not about the Westminster ultimately. It's not about anything like that. It's about whether the Bible does advocate this kind of Mosaic uniqueness as a type. You got to make a call.
Well, I think the words of Paul in Galatians 3 verse 19, the law was added.
Yes, you know? Super added. There we go. Well,
so it's, what do you mean added? Wasn't it like always, isn't the moral law like always there? No. The law was added.
Exactly.
For the purpose of increasing sin. So it's putting gospel principles on display.
Just to make, to be a tutor. Get you to embrace Christ and not be so deluded that you think you can do things without him. I mean, the whole thing was there to prove to you, you need him.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't try and do it on your own. Okay. There we go. Totelos.